Okay, thank you. So let me also first thank the organizers for setting up this workshop and bringing me here to this nice place. So I guess only mathematicians and physicists can manage to do some work here, so that's almost impossible. So today I want to talk about work with Adrian Schakel on a geometrical classification of phase transitions. And what we have in mind, or what I had in mind mainly, was a picture which is in the literature since many, many years, basically goes back to Feynman, that when you want to describe the superfluid phase transition, then you can try to picture it as a superfluid at low temperatures, which gets more and more pierced by vortex lines. And when these lines, which are in their cores normal fluid, when they become more and more and they pierce the whole superfluid, then at some point it becomes normal fluid. And what you want to describe is the statistics of these lines. And the question is whether you can understand the lambda transition purely in terms of the statistics of fluctuating lines. You can also look at crystals when you can try to understand melting in a similar fashion, that you look at dislocation or disclination lines and then try to describe the melting process as a proliferation of these topological defects. This is an example when you go to high energy physics, say lattice gauge theory or something like this, that you look at strings and how they evolve. And what I will do today is basically to go to a very simple model. So these are just spin clusters in simple magnets, and simple magnets are really simple, so that's the easing model. And maybe I speak also about the Potts model, but that's really down to the very simple problems, which has the advantage that there you get lots of quasi-exact, and in part, I'm not an expert in this, but I guess in part by now, these are also rigorous. And with exact results, I mean that in the literature there, since about 20 or 25 years, there's a rich variety on analytical results which come from Coulomb gas mappings or conformal field theory, and more recently some of these results are based on a rigorous footing by this SLE or stochastic or Schramm-Löfner evolution. So I will only mention this as a background we need. But, of course, we have not done original work in the last topic. So to set the scene, I have here a plot of a simulation of the two-dimensional easing model at two different temperatures. One at about two times the critical temperature, that's the hot phase, and another one which is very close to the critical point. And what is shown is just the direction of the spin. So black is up and white is down. And then you see these spin clusters, and that is a plot which everybody has seen, that at high temperatures there are many relatively small clusters. And when you approach DC, then large clusters start growing, and you see this big, say this black here, this big black cluster. And this is what many people are used to interpret when they look at such pictures of easing models or Potts models, that the size of the cluster, that this gives you an indication of the correlation length. So the average diameter of these clusters is the correlation length, and when you go to TC, correlation length diverges, and so also the clusters diverge. The question still is, are these the clusters which we should really take in the analysis? So these are just plots of spin up, spin down. And the answer is that these clusters are the ones which I call at least geometric clusters, and there will be in a minute another type of cluster which is a cluster line, which is slightly different from these geometric ones. But these plots up, down is what I call geometric clusters. And for these you find that in two dimensions, the percolation point, that means when this cluster grows and first touches both boundaries, so it percolates the whole system, that this happens indeed at the thermodynamically defined critical temperature. And with thermal dynamically defined, I mean that you take the two-dimensional easing model, look in Ohlenzager's solution, summing out all the spins, then you find the exact solution in this case, and you find the exact TC. So that's the sum of all spin degrees of freedom. No clusters are explicitly involved in this analysis. This is what I mean with thermodynamically determined TC. And what you find in two dimensions at least is that these clusters, which I just showed you, that they start percolating right at this temperature. And then you can look at their fractal properties. Say you count how many spins are in these clusters and take it relative to the mean diameter and then scale it, and then you find that they are fractal exponents, or you look at the boundaries of these clusters, also these are fractal exponents and critical scaling, so everything looks like the right thing. But when you go a little bit more into the details, then you find that these clusters, these geometric clusters, that they do not encode the thermodynamic critical behavior. And again, with thermodynamic critical behavior, I mean these critical exponents which you find from Ohlenzager's exact solution by summing out the spins. Moreover, and this is the most clear signal that these are not the right objects to describe the critical behavior, is that in three dimensions they do not even percolate at the right position, they percolate earlier.
That's true even in two dimensions if you take a different lattice, like a triangular lattice, then the percolation transition is an infinity, transcendence.
That's for the square lattice.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm saying you don't have to go to three dimensions to see that it's going to be choice.
Okay, so these were the geometric clusters, and now the Forch and Kösterlein clusters, which are derived by this simple two lines. So this is the original easing partition function where the spins can take the values plus or minus one. Then you can rewrite it first in this form where you simply use that this is of course a product of the exponential beta times sigma I sigma j, and since the product of sigma I sigma j can be only plus one or minus one, it's plus one when the two are equal, it's minus one when they are not equal, then you can always parameterize it in a way one constant plus another constant times the Kronecker delta of these two spins, which would be one when they are equal and zero when they are not equal, and then you can equate these two sides of this equation and you find that the coefficients here should be written like this, where p is this probability 1 minus e to the minus 2 beta. So that's an identity, and then you can use in the second line to get to arrive at this, it's also a very trivial identity, that's simply that a plus b is sum over n equals 0 and 1, and I have it in this way that I have a delta n 0 plus b delta n 1. So that's a very trivial identity, and when you insert this, then you arrive at this expression. So that was the a, the 1 minus p, and the p times delta was a b. Then you arrive at this partition function, which is now enlarged. So you have now more degrees of freedom than in the beginning. You still have the spins, but you also have these nijs, which are variables which can be 0 or 1, and are defined on the bonds of the lattice. And now you have a different statistical interpretation. So now you can check what happens when two spins pointing in the opposite direction, then this delta is 0, and then you read off from here that the nij must be always 0. So the bond is always broken between spins which point in opposite directions. So this is what you intuitively would expect, that there is no connection between spins of opposite directions. In the other case, when the two spins point in the same direction, then you have here a 1, and again you can easily read off the probability to find for these bond variables nij 0 or 1. So it's either with probability p it's 1, so the bond is set, or with 1 minus p the bond is still broken, even though the spins point in the same direction. And this is what defines the so-called Forge and Gastelein clusters. So these are clusters, bond clusters, which are connected by active bonds. So you cannot look anymore at the geometrical picture without knowing what the values of the Nijs are. You need these. But when you know the values of the Nijs, then you can follow the cluster of active bonds, and this defines then the Forge and Gastelein cluster. And since some bonds are broken between spins pointing in the same direction, these Forge and Gastelein clusters are always smaller than the geometrical clusters. And this is a well-known construction for when you do Monte Carlo simulations for the so-called cluster update algorithms, either the Swanson-Wang or the Wolf version. Those basically rely on this last equation here. So this is how it looks like. This is again close to TC, a spin configuration. So then this black one, this black cluster here, say, this would be what I had called a geometric cluster, just by looking up spin, down spins. And then you have to put these bonds between all these spins, so they are always broken between black and white, and they are sometimes broken between two black or between two white ones. And when I look only at this black one and make this construction, then I find this opaque cluster, the smaller one, which is immersed into the black one. This is then this Forge and Gastelein cluster. So it's always smaller than the geometric clusters, and this is just the Forge and Gastelein cluster from here drawn to see it clearly. And this picture is only relevant when I would do a Monte Carlo simulation with this cluster algorithm. Then I would flip this cluster here, this opaque one, which was black before, then I would flip it, and then it becomes white. And this means in one Monte Carlo step, I would go from this configuration to that configuration, and they look dramatically different, which means that the correlations from step to step are relatively small, so much, much smaller than, say, for a simple single spin flip algorithms of the Metropolis type. So you gain really orders of magnitude of computing time when you do this type of update algorithms, these cluster algorithms. But for us, it's only important that we have two types of clusters. One are the geometrical clusters, which are relatively big, and the stochastic Forge and Gastelein clusters, which are always smaller than these geometric ones.
This is the same. I'm used to thinking about FK clusters in a different way.
Yes.
It's hard temperature expansion of any model. What's the model? By the model. And then the objects that appear after you sum over the spins,
yes,
are geometric clusters. And these are FK clusters.
Yes. So how you do it? You do a high temperature expansion?
You just write the sum that you wrote.
Yes.
You do the summation of the spins. The spins disappear. The only thing that remains is summations of the loops, or, you know, clusters, where the bond is present if the, well,
for the 2D easing model, it would be loops in this case.
The lattice, I think. But, I mean,
the 3D, it would be surfaces and...
No, I'm saying on 3D, on triangle, on...
Oh, it's always loops, sorry. High temperature is always loops.
Okay. Yeah.
In any dimension, high temperatures in any dimensions are loops.
Maybe it's not high temperature expansion, maybe it's...
Well, so you write a low temperature expansion?
Well, there are two kinds of high temperature expansion, that's the thing.
I'm not saying there's no statistics involved, you just sum all the spins and you end up with some geometric picture, and in your case there was some random variable, and which was responsible, so I'm not sure I understand the connection. I am also not sure that I understand the connection to yours, but this is a standard Forge and Gastelein derivation, and then there's one step more that you can trace out also the spins. And then you end up directly with a cluster. So then you have a pure cluster representation. And you count how many clusters are there and how big they are. And then you get the weight. The number of clusters gives you the weight for the configuration. That's the last step of the Forge and Gastelein. So if you mean this and you are right, this is an intermediate step.
Yeah,
to the full cluster representation. So there's one step more to arrive what probably you have in mind for the full cluster representation.
No, I think I could go from the first line directly to the full cluster representation without any ends. That's what I'm saying. I
mean, probably you can, yes, yeah. Yeah. Probably you can do that as well. But the clusters are the same. I mean,
yeah, that's what I hope.
The objects are the same in the end.
Well, I think you get a probability for having a bond related to your.
Yes.
That's the picture. So you start. Yeah, that's the weight of
exactly.
So the weight.
Yeah, the weight.
The pictures,
so exactly.
Then the weights
given
in terms of feet.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one step further, but it's exactly the same objects which enter. Okay, and now we have these objects, either these geometrical clusters or the Fortune crystalline clusters, and now we want to analyze them in terms of a percolation picture. So that is what we ask. Is it possible to use a percolation type analysis and arrive at the proper critical exponents of the model, which in this case for 2D is in Bino? So we look at the distribution of these clusters, for example. So with mass, I mean it's just the number of spins in a given cluster. Then we make an histogram and measure what is the distribution. Or we could also look at the boundary. So how many spins are in the boundary? And then look how these numbers are distributed. And the general assumption is that they are distributed according to this law. So there's a power dependence and an exponential suppression factor, which is only there when we are away from the percolation point. So at the percolation point, it's a pure power law, so it's scale invariance at the critical point. And if we are away of it, then there's an exponential suppression which is governed by this term. Well, and this one can first of all check, and this we have done by doing simulations of the two-dimensional easing model at criticality, so then theta is equal to zero, and we expect a pure power law, and this is what is shown here. That's a log-log plot. N is the number of spins in a cluster. Ln divided by the system size is just how many of such clusters are there, and then this histogram is plotted log-log, and if it is log-log, then it should be linear. If it is a power law, and what you see, it is indeed linear, and here we plotted a slope which is minus 31 over 15, and the question is now, is this related to the standard critical exponents? And well, many of you simply know that this is related, and for this we recall that one quantity one looks in the percolation interpretation is the so-called percolation strength. So it simply counts the number of sites in the largest cluster which you find in one configuration of clusters. And the average cluster size is related to the susceptibility in the standard definition. Standard definition would be that you measure spin Si times Sj and then sum over all possible pairing, so the standard definition of the susceptibility. Finite size scaling then tells you that the strength should scale like this. The xi is a correlation length with an exponent ratio beta over nu, and the susceptibility should scale with an exponent gamma over nu, and these two are scaling functions which depend only on this ratio, lattice size divided by correlation length. When you now insert, this representation for the number of such clusters into, say, here, and do a little algebra with that, then you find a relation between this gamma over nu and this tau, and in principle also the sigma, but now we are at the critical point, so only the tau enters, which gives you a relation between the standard critical exponents, beta over nu, and gamma over nu, in terms of this tau, and the tau was defined here by the decay of this number density for the cluster sizes. When you solve this for tau, then you get an expression in terms of beta and gamma, And then you use the standard critical values for beta and gamma of the 2D easing model, 1/8 and 7 over 4 for gamma. And when you plug it in, then you find indeed this number for tau, which is 31 over 15. And this was the slope which I had plotted here without doing a real fit. I just had the data and plotted the slope with the correct value. So this means that these were the Fortune crosstalk clusters. So I should have emphasized this. We looked at the Fortune, at the sizes, at the size distribution of the Fortune crosstalk cluster, and then this can be related to the critical exponents, to the standard critical exponents of the underlying spin model. And this is not specific to the 2D easing model, that's an example, but that would work for any POTS model, for example. Then we can also look at fractal dimensions, defined in the standard way, that we compute the radius of gyration of a cluster, then look how many spins are in the cluster, and then it should scale with this exponent ratio, where d is a fractal dimension. And this can be related to the correlation length scaling, where the exponent nu enters, and what one finds then is that the sigma, which was the exponent which governs the exponential decay of the distribution, that this is related to the exponent nu, which is at least very plausible, because when you are away from criticality, the psi is finite, and the distance to criticality is somehow governed by this exponent nu, and therefore it enters in the relation with sigma. And the tau exponent of the power law, that can be also written in terms of the fractal dimension in this way. So when we have this, or when we measure this, these two exponents, the tau and the sigma from the exponential decay, then we can always compute back the critical exponents, the standard critical exponents, nu, beta, gamma, and the other ones. And this we tried now in a simulation. So the first one is completely standard. So we did a normal Monte Carlo simulation of the 2D easing model. Then we analyzed the Fortune crosstalk clusters, which is completely standard because it is known as improved estimators for the magnetization and the susceptibility. So that would, you would always do when you do a cluster simulation, you would always measure these types of percolation quantities. And then you do a finite size scaling fit, so you have lattice sizes from 64, in this case to 512. And what you expect was one or two slides back, that the susceptibilities should scale like lattice size to the exponent gamma over nu. And when you analyze it, then you find in this case this number, which is of course extremely close to the exact result, 7 over 4, and also for the magnetic exponent beta over nu, the number is in this case extremely close to 1 over 8. So everything is fine for the Fortune crosstalk cluster. So when you analyze the Fortune crosstalk clusters, you really see the critical behavior. But in the simulation, of course, we also have always the geometric clusters. So we have the spin field, and so we can always look also what is the distribution of the geometric clusters. And when we do now the same game, what we did for the Fortune crosstalk clusters, for the geometric clusters, again look at the average size, look at the fraction of spins in the largest geometric cluster, and do a finite size scaling, then we get these two lines, which are not so easy to see here. So this is log-log. This is the lattice size. This is the susceptibility computed from the geometric cluster. And again, we find a very nice straight line. And when we now estimate what the slope is, do a fit, then we find this number. And when we do the similar analysis for the magnetization or for the percolation strength, then we find this number. Well, and these numbers are very close to these fractions. So within error bars, this is just this fraction, 91 over 48. And this is within error bars, it's just 5 over 96. And the question is, of course, these are not the standard easing exponents. Where are they coming from?
These are percolation exponents.
They are also not the percolation exponents.
I mean, they're very similar.
They are very similar, but they are not the percolation exponents.
But, how do you go from the number to the fraction?
Well, that is guesswork, but or to be honest, we knew the answer, which I show you now.
If you would, for instance, do something like a continued fraction expansion to get the closest, you wouldn't get these guys.
No, I would. No, you are perfectly right. When I have only this number and would have no theoretical prejudice, then I would not dare to guess that this is 91 over 48. But we had already a theoretical prejudice, which I show you now.
Also, I have another question which relates to your previous transparency.
Yes.
Ising, you have shown us...
This one? Oh,
yeah, oh yes, well, these guys, yes. You, for Ising, you have shown that you can look at two quantities related to clusters and then recover the critical exponents,
yep,
percentage exponents. But if you go to plots, for instance, you will have more critical exponents.
Why?
No, down, wrong.
No, it's the same number.
The same number?
Three state pots, four state pots, they all have beta, gamma, nu, eta, no, little delta.
There are critical phenomena where you have more than two independent critical exponents.
Yeah, but not for the pots case.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the pots are, I mean, from this qualitative point of view, they are not different from the Ising. The only difference is where it becomes a little bit more tricky is the four state pots, because there you have logarithmic corrections on top of the standard scaling, and so things become more complicated there. But the three-state pots at least is basically the same as a 2D easing as far as the qualitative features are concerned. Okay, so the question which we had basically answered before is where are these exponents coming from? And this is now a summary slide of, I don't know, 25 years of literature, something like this. Starting with, well, I guess it started really with Nienhuis, and there were many other people who contributed by Coulomb gas mappings, conformal field theory, guessing, conjecturing critical exponents, getting systematics, and in the end, this is what you can summarize of it. For the general everything is in two dimensions now, for the two-dimensional Q-state Hotz model, use first of all this parameterization, which I think goes back to Nienhuis in a different notation, and the kappa is a kappa almost the kappa of the SLE. And by now I regret that we changed the notation, so our kappa bar, so we put a bar so that we can distinguish it, is kappa over 4. And you will see it. This has a reason in the end. So maybe the SLE people know or can guess what the reason is. At some point there pops up a 16, which we get rid of when we define it that way. Okay, so that's the way we define it. And then everything, if we do everything consistently, then the central charge can be expressed in that way. So when you want to know the central charge of a Q-state Pots model, then you first have to plug in Q here, compute what the kappa bar is, then you can plug in kappa bar here, and then you find the C, and also all the other critical exponents can be expressed in terms of this kappa bar, or if you want, in terms of the Q, essentially. So we know all the critical exponents. I've given only a few here. For the Q-state Pots model, even if you take the Q as a continuous parameter, so even for 1.7, you would know what the critical exponent is. The fractal dimension is also known. And then here I've only given a few examples to check. Maybe the most prominent one is just standard percolation, uncorrelated percolation, where, of course, people here are more used to the fact that kappa is 6. So when I multiply by 4, it's indeed 6. So at least this matches. And for the Ising case, which I would take mostly as example, we have with our kappa bar 4/3, and otherwise it would be 16 over 3. Okay, so there's a trivial factor of 4, which is different. And now, also this is an observation which can be traced back to the literature. Not exactly in these words, but it goes basically back to Duplanqui, is that when you look at this expression here, then you see, of course, that the central charge is given as a function of this kappa, is a quadratic function. So it has two solutions. So for the same central charge, there are two possible kappa values. And these are the two solutions, which are not particularly illuminating, but these are two. And they have the property that's from the type of equation we have, that the two solutions multiply, if you multiply them, it must be one. So that's given by this quadratic equation. And what we therefore see is that we stay in the same central charge sector when we go from kappa to 1 over kappa. And this is this duality mapping which was derived in the Coulomb gas picture first by Duplanqui. And I think also here it was mentioned several times that there's a duality by going from kappa to 16 over kappa. And this was the reason why we introduced a factor of 4, because now we can go from kappa to 1 over kappa with our BART notation, which we like more than the 16, factor, which of course is the same. Now we have now kappa bar goes to 1 over kappa bar. And this substitution, and this was a conjecture by Duplanqui, is that when you do this substitution everywhere in all these formulas for the critical exponents or for the fractal dimensions, then you derive the critical exponents which are related to the geometric clusters. So going from the Fortune-Castle line, which corresponds to the kappa, so Q gives you kappa, then you make the replacement, kappa goes to into 1 over kappa, and then the claim is when you do this in all the formulas for the critical exponents, then you get the values for the critical exponents which are related to the geometrical cluster. And this is only one equation, that's a fractal dimension for the Fortune-Castle line, which I had quoted on the last slide here. That's the same, of course, as here. And then to go to the geometric or to the fractal dimension of the geometric clusters, we replace everywhere kappa goes into 1 over kappa, and then we end up with this, and if we do it in all the other formulas, then we have the whole set of critical exponents which are related to the geometric clusters. This is, of course, very formal, and you can do this much more constructive by really constructing a model which corresponds to this substitution. So that's a model which has the same central charge as the original model. And this, of course, one can in principle identify. And for the 2D easing model, this has been identified also a long time ago by Cornelio van der Sande, and Stanley was also involved in some of these papers. So there are many, many people involved. And it turns out that this is a diluted percolation model. And this diluted percolation model has a tricritical point. And these exponents, which are related to the geometric clusters of the standard 2D easing model, they encode the tricritical behavior of a related model. And this is this related model. The 2D easing model, the related model is a diluted Q equals 1 Potts model, so percolation model with dilution. And the tricritical branch of this. Whether we can go back,
yeah.
I don't know.
Because this time you have more than
It, there are mappings in other models where you can exactly this question, where you can go also the other way. In this case, I'm not sure whether you can do it. So. And then you use this, the simple substitution, just to check that things make sense. For Q equals 2 easing model, we have kappa bar is 4 over 3. Then we can compute from here the fractal dimension of the geometric clusters. And once we have the fractal dimension, then we can also compute this gamma over nu. And when you plug in all these numbers, then you in fact find that gamma over nu should be 91 over 48. And this is how we guessed that it should be 91 over 48. Okay, so it was not pure guesswork. There was some reasoning behind it. When you look in the literature, there were other conjectures, which was something, I don't remember exactly, something like 90 over 48. And that was in the 90s, the Monte Carlo simulations in the 90s were consistent also with 90 over 48. So you need relatively precise data to see a difference of 1 over 48 in critical exponents. That's not completely straightforward to check with numerics. So next, we looked at the boundaries of these clusters, and there you have in general to distinguish at least two different types. So one is the so-called hull, that is this one, and the other is the external perimeter, which is only important, this difference, when you look at these stochastic clusters of the Fortune-Castelein type. The difference is the following. So here are all the spins, the yellow ones and the blue ones, belong to one cluster. And then I've also drawn these active bonds here. The thick black lines are the active bonds. And when I trace out the boundary in the sense of the hull, say I start here, then I have to follow always connections which are given by active bonds. So I can go this way, but I cannot go here because there is no active bond. So I have to follow this fjord here and come back that way. So that's the way how it is defined, how the hull is defined as a boundary of the cluster. So in general, you have to follow, and that's a trivial example, but there may be very deep fjords which you have to follow. So it could look like something, this is a boundary, then there's a fjord, comes back, and like this. Then the hull would follow the whole line, so that would count as a boundary. While the external perimeter only checks whether the next neighbor spin is there or not. But so therefore it would go that way.
On the left, your definition of the hull, actually, you have several clusters there, but you only have a single hull. And usually we...
That's one cluster. It's irritating with the colors. So yellow and blue belong to the same cluster. They are all connected.
Which is the clusters?
The whole thing. All spins are belong to the same cluster.
These are FK clusters that you drew?
Yeah. But they are all connected. No? That's active bonds.
I think the dots are spins. So four by five block is a spin cluster.
Yeah.
The dots are spins, right?
The dots are spins, yes. So the dots, yeah, the dots are spins and the heavy lines...
Definition, let's suppose that we just have let's suppose that we have a single isolated side, which is one FK cluster, and we have a whole bunch of those. Let's suppose that we just have a whole lattice full of single site FK clusters.
Yes.
Then your construction of the hull there would lump them all together, wouldn't it?
Would be zero in this case.
Well, no, not a full lattice, but let's... you see, usually we draw the hull on the medial lattice.
Yes, exactly.
On which lattice, the dual? Or?
On the medial lattice.
Medial or surrounding lattice, it's sometimes called.
Okay.
It's lattice drawn joining the middle points of the lines on your picture.
From here, huh?
No, middle points of the lines.
Middle of the lines, okay.
Yeah.
So those are curves on that.
But I guess, again, that is the same. Yeah. That's just, at least for the square lattice, it's just a translation by one half lattice unit.
Yeah, but you have to say in which direction it's a translation. That's the problem. So in my example, where you have lots and lots of single site FK clusters, you would say that there was no hull at all. And I would say that there are lots of small hulls.
That's right.
Probably in the scaling limit, it doesn't make any difference.
I mean, that is a very extreme example, these single site clusters.
I know it's an extreme example, but because the hulls that I've defined have the nice property that they're also the hulls of the dual clusters at the same time. And your hulls are not the hulls of the dual clusters.
Okay.
But anyway, it probably doesn't make any difference.
I mean, yeah, for the scaling, I'm pretty sure that it doesn't matter.
In the old discussion, Weissenmann, Haroni and Berwick was dealing in the 70s, you remember?
Yeah.
They defined the hull as the one which is allowed to go through the smallest openings in the
cluster. Allowed to go through.
But that is the same.
Right, it's the same.
That is the same.
And then what's known is that in the scaling limit, it doesn't matter whether you close just the smallest openings or twice the smallest openings.
For the external perimeter.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, I agree with that. I'm just looking at the hull.
But this is, I mean, this Aharoni and the other was Aharoni and...
Aharoni and...
I also forgot. Yeah. But this paper we looked, of course. And it's, I mean, maybe up to translations that it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that is also where the fjord picture, I mean, that is explicitly from this Aharoni.
But the hull couldn't pass in between them.
Okay, I guess we should discuss it maybe. It's pretty detailed. One has to draw pictures, otherwise we would not figure out. But it's, I mean, the principal difference is clear. So, I mean, once we follow the set bonds, whether which precise definition we can maybe clarify, then we get this type of boundary, which, or in this case, we would follow this. So it's much more rugged than the external perimeter, which just straightens out these fjords. So basically it cuts the fjords, so it's in a sense it's a smoother version of the boundary. Of course, this difference does not show up for the geometric cluster, which we define only as clusters of sites. So it's a site cluster. So we have not the concept of whether we should follow an active bond or not. And also for this, there are predictions which I do not derive, which I just collect from the literature. This is for the hull of the forging crystalline cluster. One can express it with a kappa bar in this way, and for the external parameter in that way. So it's, again, a type of duality. Kappa goes into 1 over kappa. And once we have the fractal dimensions, and we can also express the gamma over nu ratios, which are basically d minus 1 times 2, so it's either kappa or it's 1 over kappa. For the geometric cluster, there is no distinction between the hull and the external perimeter. And when we now apply again this dual mapping, kappa goes into 1 over kappa, then we can derive that, that for the geometric cluster, that's the G, the hull is the same as the external perimeter for the Fortune crustal line. So, and then we find as a value for this exponent ratio geometric cluster, the hull of it is 1 over kappa, and the external perimeter of the geometric cluster is the same. And what we should see when we measure now the finite size scaling of the boundaries, either defined as a hull or as the external perimeter, we should see either 4 over 3 for this exponent, or 3 over 4. And these are the results of a Monte Carlo simulation, where the same as before, but now we analyze the cluster boundaries. These are the susceptibilities that once for the hull and once for the external perimeter, so that is for the Fortune cluster line, so that's the hull, external perimeter, geometric clusters, only the hull, and the slopes, which I guess you cannot see, these are in green, there are slopes. These slopes are this number, 1.329, so it's not 4 over 3 exactly, but comes very close. And when we go to the geometric clusters, then we see it's 3 over 4. That is this slope. So all the conjectured exponents are consistent with the numerical data when you accept that there are small deviations in the third digit also. There are some small problems also with this with the numerics, which I don't want to go into detail. So there's some strange behavior in some quantities. Here you see there are strong corrections to finite size scaling. So basically it only starts for very large lattices. That's the asymptotic slope. Really comes up, and in this case there's an even more severe problem which we simply do not understand. You see, if you look carefully at it, this fit was done for small lattice sizes, 8 to 48. When we go to the large lattice sizes, then we get the wrong exponent. So, I mean, there's a drift in the exponent, and it goes away from the value it should be. So something is fishy with that.
Do you allow the clusters to wrap around the torus?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's a question of whether you should allow that or not.
We checked this, yes. And in general, at least for the mass,
yeah.
Well, I think here we did not. For the masses, I mean, just counting the spins in the cluster, there we did both. So we excluded the wrapping, and we included them, and when you include them, you have the wrapping clusters, then the finite size scaling is much better in the sense that the corrections are much smaller than when you exclude it. So I did it automatically because I was used to use it as an improved estimator for a standard Monte Carlo simulation, and there you never care about excluding something. So that was simply not fashionable to do. And so I did it automatically that way. And then when I looked at other paper where people did similar analysis, in percolation theory you usually exclude it.
Yeah.
And so I also tried it, and then I was surprised that the finite size scaling corrections are much, much stronger than you exclude. So it's much better to include them. But we did it only for the mass of the cluster. With the boundaries, we didn't do it, because then it becomes very tricky how to compute the boundary when you have the spanning cluster. And therefore, in this case, we did not do it. Okay, so this is a summary of the different distributions. These are all these predicted rational numbers from whatever you like, Coulomb-Gauss mapping, conformal field theory, and probably also most of them at least now rigorously from SLE. At criticality, so you always see these power laws, and there are these straight lines are just with a given exponents to check that this is all right. So in this case, everything works perfectly. So now I guess I have to hurry a little bit. So this I will not go into detail. That's just a funny exercise, which basically has a motivation from quantum gravity. So this is a model where you try to sum over all metrics of space. So that is the pure gravity model, quantum gravity model, takes basically the idea of a normal path integral. So you write down the normal action, and then you sum over all possible paths connecting A with B. That gives you the standard quantum mechanics. When you do quantum gravity, at least one approach is that you write down the standard action, and now instead of summing over all possible paths, you are summing over all possible metrics. So that is the basic idea. And then you hope that at the end of the day, or at the end of the of 10 years or something, you really come up with something which is consistently quantum gravity. And this is mimicked, the summing over all geometries is mimicked by taking, say, a triangulation and then dynamically flip the connectivities. And with dynamically flipping the connectivities, that's one example. Say you have here this two triangles which are glued in that way, then the flip move would be to have the outer ones the same, but now you connect it in that way. And this you do throughout the whole lattice, and in this way you see that the connectivity, say at this vertex, which maybe had here some other exit, some other triangles merging there, it has four neighboring lines, and after the flip it has five. So the connectivities are constantly varying, and then you interpret when it is six and it is flat, and the number of nearest neighbors is six, it's flat. When seven or five, then there is curvature. And this you go all over the lattice, and in this way you get these funny fractal looking lattices, and they are in fact highly fractal. The fractal dimension of these is known to be about four. So they are really highly fractal objects. So this is a lattice, and then you can put, if you want, you can put on the vertices again your spins. And study now a spin model on top of this fluctuating type of lattice. And the surprising answer is that all the critical properties can also be computed for this type of model. So that's a annealed disorder in this case. And there's a famous relation with a standard critical exponent, or in this case, these are the conformal weights, due to KPZ. That's not Kara, Parisi, Sung, that's Knishik, Polyakov, and Samolodchikov. And they relate a model which has central charge C, some conformal weight, some critical exponent, on a standard flat square, say, lattice. Then they relate this to these fluctuating manifolds, and this formula gives you then this delta twiddle, and delta twiddle is a critical exponent for the easing model coupled to this fluctuating manifold. So this is by now fairly standard that you can do it, and then of course you can derive easily a relation with the standard critical exponents, beta over nu, or again the fractal dimension. And then you can do the same game. Then you study an easing model on these fluctuating lattices. Again, you can define clusters. You can define both types, geometric and Porzing-Kastelein. And this is what you get for the Porzing-Kastelein clusters. This is the value which you get for the pure easing model, which I showed you before. These are the numbers which we had before. From this, you can calculate what delta is. Once you have the delta, and you know that C is equal 1/2 for the easing model, then you can calculate the delta twiddle. When you have delta twiddle, then you can calculate D twiddle. And in this way, you get the prediction for the fractal dimensions of the Porzing-Kastelein clusters and the geometric clusters on these fluctuating manifolds. So the first line was fairly standard, because people have studied, of course, before the standard easing model on this fluctuating quantum gravity background. And this is now the new prediction by using the value for the geometric clusters on the flat lattices, by going through this KPZ mapping, then we get the prediction for the fractal dimension of these geometric clusters. Beta C, for a certain type of these triangulations, even beta C is known exactly. In fact, it's even simpler to solve the easing model on these fluctuating manifolds than on the flat lattice, because you can even solve it in magnetic field. It's at first sight may be surprising that this more complicated wiggly model is easier to solve than the standard Ohnsager type of solution. Okay, this is known, so we can go to the critical point, which helps, of course, that we know exactly where criticality is. Then we do the simulation as before, measure the Swenson-Wang cluster, the size distribution, or the susceptibility, then do the fit, then we get these exponents, and when we do this, as is shown here, again a log-log plot, finite size scaling plot, these are then the measured values, and this was a conjecture, should get 5/6, for the Porzing-Kastelein, or 11/12 for the geometric ones. The agreement is not perfect, so there is some deviation already in the second digit. There are third, maybe, so it's the 6 here in the third digit. So it's not perfect, but we have not included so far any corrections to finite size scaling. And this is what we did next. We used an effective lattice size which includes corrections to the leading scaling, that would be the leading term. And the corrections in this case are extremely strong, because the fractal dimension of these objects is 4. So the linear extent is always effectively very small. Even if you have many points, then you always have a very small linear extent. And when you include this, okay, then the estimates improve. And within the error bars, which are then also larger, because we have now here also these constants, these amplitudes L0 and L1, then within these error bars, everything is consistent. So I think we can claim that also in this case, everything comes out the way it should be. So the last thing I want to show you is an alternative simulation in this case by using the high temperature, not really the high temperature representation of the model. This is a standard representation that you have fugacity times the number of the active or of the bonds in the lattice, where V is the hyperbolic tangent of beta. And then high temperature means at very high temperatures you have maybe one or two of these little squares which are excited. They count them, each counts four links, so it's beta to the four. If you have two, it's beta to the eight, or this hexagon has beta to the six. So that's the systematic way of deriving the high temperature expansion. And when you go close to TC, then these loops become longer and longer, and they start again to percolate. And in fact, for the 2D easing model, there's a close relation to the geometric clusters, because in two dimensions there's duality, and so the high temperature graphs are just the boundaries of the low temperature excitations, where you overturn one spin and then you draw the boundary, and there's a one-to-one mapping up to small finite size corrections which are different. Because then you, in this case for the high temperature representation, we can have a graph which wraps once around the lattice. But when we are in the low temperature expansion and create these objects by flipping spins, then I can flip spins in a row, but I then have always two lines. So in this sense, there is a small difference between the duality on finite lattices. So duality is violated on finite lattices. That's the easiest to say. And when you take the infinite volume limit, then these large lines are suppressed, and then duality is recovered. But in, up to these minor differences, by analyzing these loops in the directly simulated high temperature expansion, we get the boundaries of the geometric cluster, or the length distribution of these boundaries. The update is very simple. So we plug in plaquettes and say, if here's already a plaquette, and we try to add one here, then the rule is at a link where there was already a line, this line is deleted, so 1 plus 1 is 0, and if there was 0, then it is there. So plugging in a plaquette here would go from this figure 8 type graph to this one. If I would plug in again a plaquette on top of this, then all four lines would be erased, and effectively I have discarded one of these little squares. And this one can do systematically with a type Metropolis type of simulation. Then you can measure the length again of these objects, can calculate the percolation strength, which was the number of elements in the largest cluster, or the average cluster size, which is basically the susceptibility. Again, this is finite size scaling, and here you look at the maximum. Look here, that's easier. You look at the maximum of these peaks of the susceptibility as a function of inverse temperature in this case. Then again, we make finite size scaling in the log-log plot. And so the slope gives us the critical exponent. And then in this way, we find that gamma, or gamma over nu is equal to 1, is this number, 748, which is, of course, very close to the predicted 3 over 4. So that's an alternative way to get the boundaries of the geometric clusters, which is a little bit more stable and easier to analyze than doing it directly from the spin clusters and then tracing out the boundaries. The outlook here, this I want to be extremely short. We have also looked at two-dimensional ON models with varying N from minus 1 to 1, and then one can again look at the distribution of these loop lengths and relate it to the critical behavior. Then one can include vacancy in this model, and in this case it's known that it is related to a tricritical behavior, and this can be also analyzed in terms of these loop lengths. And for this we find in fact that there is some mapping between the ON model to the Q-state POTS model. And then the fortune, the hulls of the fortune crystalline clusters of the Fortune-Castellan clusters are related to the quadratical behavior in this diluted O-N model. But to go into these details, that would take another hour or so. That is what I started out with in the introduction. So this is a plot of the vortex lines in a very, very simple model for liquid helium that's justified to the four field theory with complex fields, which mimics the symmetry which is in liquid helium. And these vortex lines is when you look at the, because there's a phase now, so the phase can, when you're on a lattice, the phase can just curl around. So the spins, when I plot the phase, I spin something like this. And I draw spin vectors for this, and it can curl around, and then there would be a vortex line which goes in that direction. And by analyzing the spin or the field configurations, one can derive what the vortex line configuration is. So this is in a sense similar to tracing out the clusters in a spin model. So you have the spins, and then you define the clusters. Here we have spins or fields and define the vortex lines. This is at very low temperatures. There are only a few excitations. And when you go to higher temperatures, there are, of course, many. And then you can try to analyze this network of lines in a similar fashion as we did before. Look again at spanning probability or loop length distributions. And what we find here is that sometimes it fits, assuming that by analyzing this network of vortex lines, we should get the critical exponents of the O2 symmetry class. So that is in three dimensions in this case. In some cases not. And the main problem is that one does not really know how to handle situations where vortex lines cross each other. So whether this is a knot, so that both parts, which are this and that directions, belong to one cluster of vortex lines, or whether they avoid each other, and then we have two clusters which are both much smaller. And so the cluster size distribution would be different. In a sense, this corresponds to stochastically breaking some of the connections. So somehow we would need a prescription a la Fortune-Castellan to go from these geometrically, purely geometrically defined objects to go to some which sometimes breaks these knots and sometimes glue them together. And we tried this, so we used a systematic variation of probability for breaking and checked whether there is a difference in the network properties, but the result is not really unique, so it's very difficult to say what is the right rule. So we would need some derivation a la Fortune-Castellan, which we do not know.
I don't understand. You know the microscopic model in a lattice, you should be able to decide what is happening.
The microscopic model is either the phi to the 4 field theory or the XY model. But
these vortex lines actually intersect.
They intersect, so there's no way. So this is the rule. So the rule is that you have lines which have a divergence zero condition, and so it's completely consistent that it comes, flows in, flows out, and from here flows in, flows out. So the divergence zero condition is satisfied. So that's the rule. And if you take this series, then you do not get, I mean, if you analyze this network of vortex lines, then you don't get the correct critical behavior.
You could do it on another lattice, on one of these lattices of coordination number
three, or maybe it works.
Yeah.
But it's in three dimensions.
Yeah,
it's possible.
Yeah,
we should talk about this once more. So I mean, this is still open. And I mean, this is a problem which is around since Feynman conjectured it many, many years back. And it goes back and forth. So some people claim it's complete nonsense to ask this question, whether the vortex lines or these line ensembles encode the whole critical behavior, with very prominent people in this group. So Michael Fisher completely disagrees with this picture. And other people say there must be some way, because if you use, say, an XY model as a starting point in the Villain representation, then you have a one-to-one duality mapping between the spin model to this type of vortex line. So somehow it must be encoded. But still it's not clear. And my suspicion is that we have the same problem as we have with the geometric clusters in the Ising model. If we would use the geometric objects, then we would never end up with a critical behavior. Only when we use these stochastically defined clusters, then we get the critical behavior. And this stochastic element is somehow missing in this context. Well, in the last example, this is you can go further and further with this topological classification. This is a three-dimensional compact abelian Higgs model, which is relevant for the standard model, for example. And there you can also analyze everything in terms of lines, and in this case also point-like defects. So these are monopole lines, or vortex lines, and single monopoles, which are connected by these lines. And then you can try to, again, do the statistics of these purely geometrical objects. Much of this is standard folklore, so you find it in many papers. But to my knowledge, at least, it has never really worked out. So there are many open questions when you go into the details. So the pictures are nice and very intuitive. But when you want to do real statistical mechanics with this picture, then you have big problems, also numerically, because it's not easy to construct these dual objects in a simulation. And in many cases, you cannot simulate them directly. It's much too expensive to simulate them directly. Usually, they have long-range interactions, and so you can forget it. So you do the spin model type of simulation, construct these objects, and then try to make an analysis with these objects, and that makes it so hard. And that's all I want to say. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your talk and all these nice perspectives. That magician was certainly trying to point. Are there more questions?
Yeah, when we go back to the three-dimensional O2 models, so
yes,
the complex order of parameters, have people looked at questions of the statistics of the entanglement of the vortex lines? So if you ask, you know, how many, you know, the number of vortex lines are entangled as a system in a particular way as a function of system size or something?
I know, but I'm not aware of. We also didn't try. Also in this type of analysis, you easily overlook this question. Because what you do is you start following one of these loops. And if there's another one which is entangled, you don't notice. At least not when you're not. And to detect this, I'm not sure how I would do it. It's not so easy. I mean, you could, of course, you could put force on it and see that you cannot. But to implement this is very hard. And you have to analyze many thousands or ten thousands of configurations, so everything must be fast. So and I think nobody has asked this question. This may be important. I mean, I'm not sure.
If I go back to the Ising model on just a static lattice.
Yes.
Thanks to SLE, we know lots more beyond critical exponents about this. So have you done or thought about doing computations of something beyond the critical exponents to compare with SLE? For example, like what Michelle and Denis Carnot did?
The rich quantities, for example?
Well, I forget what they compute. I mean, you can compute, if you put on Gaussian boundary conditions and force an interface in there, that interface is presumably SLE3 for the geometric clusters. And you can then, if you leave one end free, there's an exact computation for the hitting distribution.
But the plus minus interface.
Plus minus interface.
So, and you can, probably not aware. So, what can you compute for that?
Well, you should ask the person who computed it, who's sitting over there.
Well, you can force the interface to start at some point.
Yeah.
You have to sit on the strip, you force the interface to start at some point in the lower boundary, and then you compute the hitting distribution on the upper boundary.
Okay.
That's something you can do.
Okay.
Anyway, with this, actually, you need to go and then ask the interface.
Okay.
But the more general question is, there are lots of things that should come out of SLE beyond the critical exponents that you could then compare with the simulations.
No, we have not.
Okay.
So maybe I can learn about it.
Well,
there are no more questions, and thank you again.